International House of Horrors.
Valued guests, and welcome back to the International House of Horrors podcast, your sanctuary is spooky for all things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre. I am one of your curators here at the house, Joe Merle.
And I'm Josh. Hi.
Hello, Josh. How is life in Germany, Deutschland?
Yeah, just before we started podcasting, we talked about how everything is banned over here, so life is miserable.
I hate it here.
Everything is good. Everything is fine.
Everything is good. That is good, my friend. I was listening to Rammstein the other day, and I like that song, Deutschland. That's a good track.
It's really good.
Yeah, that's a solid one. Every once in a while, I'll go back and listen to what they got going on, and it's such a weird... just amalgam of so many different kinds of music. Like, it's not really, like, it's like industrial, rock, electric, and now you've got him, like, doing rap songs, and it's...
He is completely crazy, but, he also writes children's poetry.
I think does
children's
he really?
Poetry. Yeah, Till Lindemann, he's crazy, and, yeah.
That doesn't really surprise me, though. He seems like a guy who just looks for different creative outlets and is not afraid to... just try it, you know, try it. Whatever happens, happens. It's, but I always like, I mean, and they've been around a long time now. It's been like, 25 years maybe?
Yeah, at least since the 90s. Yeah. And they are crazy. Like, Rammstein, you might say they are the biggest German band out
there
right now.
Maybe ever?
Maybe ever. Well, we can go as far back and say, like, well, maybe Beethoven. But they're filling the halls everywhere. Like, I feel like sometimes they are bigger overseas than they are over here in Germany.
I think they are. They and, you know, that's not uncommon even for some. There's some American bands that are huge overseas but don't really... I mean, they do well here, but not as big as they do... in other parts of the world. But
that's mostly in Japan. Those bands who no one knows, but they're like the biggest thing in Japan for some reason.
Biggest thing in Japan. But yeah, Rammstein is, I mean, over here, they've been huge forever. You know, they still draw huge crowds and will continue to do so. Part of it is their stage show is just incredible. Yeah, all the pyrotechnics and you haven't seen them?
No, I
Josh,
haven't seen
what
them
the
live. It's really hard to see them live over here because... everything is sold out like minute one.
Yeah,
like
a coworker
of mine just got was really excited because he got tickets for Rammstein in England. He's flying to England to see Rammstein because who knows when to see them.
Right? Do they play a lot of shows in Germany?
Probably more than outside, but it's not that many. Like, it's mostly really big venues or like festivals. Yeah.
Like huge concert venues and, like you said, the big festivals. Well, hopefully one day you'll get to see them on like the reunion tour in 40 years from now.
Maybe.
When they're out there. Bunch of geriatrics.
My dad is also a big Rammstein fan, so that's interesting because I could go see a concert with him.
That'd be cool. You know what though? It's good music. You can it's not like it's a weird niche thing. Even it is good for the most part. And I think because they pull from so many different places, a lot of different individuals could enjoy it. You know, even if you're an electronic music fan, you can really enjoy it. If you're a metal music fan, you can really enjoy it. It's a good blend. Good blend. But we're not here to talk about German music. We are a horror movie podcast. So we're going to be back to normal now for a little while. Back with the Twilight Zone. We're getting very close to the end of season one. I was looking through the episodes last night, I couldn't remember where we were. When I was going to watch the episode, because we had jumped and did the other one and then skipped a week, and I was like, oh, shit, which one are we at? And then I figured it out. I was like, oh, okay, I know where we're at. So today's
I actually watched this episode like 2 weeks back or three when we first planned on doing the episode, and then we kind of... oh, then I got sick, and so we didn't do the episode.
Right.
And so I watched it back then, so now I hope... that was the right thing back there.
Okay, so let's see if it's the right one. It is season one, episode 29 of The Twilight Zone, Nightmare as a Child.
Okay, yeah, that's the one I watched.
Okay,
<That's>
perfect. The original air date in the States was April 29th, 1960. This was written by Serling. And again, it's got it doesn't have the producer on it. I thought this was another Buck Houghton episode, but I don't see it listed here. It might be. Might be another one of his, but I'm unsure.
Yep, it is.
Oh, okay, perfect. And so this aired, like I said, April 29th, 1960 on CBS. I'll do the opening narration, and then we'll jump in and talk about this episode a little bit. Month of November, hot chocolate and a small cameo of a child's face, imperfect only in its solemnity. And these are the improbable ingredients to a human emotion. An emotion, say, like fear. But in a moment, this woman, Helen Foley, will realize fear. She will understand what are the properties of terror. And a little girl will lead her by the hand and walk with her into a nightmare. All right. So the episode opens up with Helen Foley. She's kind of our lead, who is played by Janice Rule, who I thought did a really good job in this episode.
Yeah,
and sure. As I was looking on the Wikipedia page, it said was an American actress at her most convincing playing embittered, neurotic socialites. So she in this one, she's not really a socialite character, but she is someone who's sort of neurotic. And I think that comes across really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. She did a really good job in conveying that emotion. And she's a school teacher who just comes home from work. Lives in an apartment building. She comes in and there's a little girl sitting on the stairs. So there's apartments upstairs. And her apartment's just off to the left. This little girl begins to talk to her. It really kind of strange, though, that she just invites this kid in right away. I guess it was a different time.
Yeah. It was kind of weird. Like, yeah, come in. You want a tea? And like, it's just like the normal thing to do, to pick up some people just from
right.
the stairs.
and it's very strange right from the get-go, because she tells her, or she invites her in for hot chocolate. And she's like, yeah, I'll have hot chocolate. You have some too, but you don't like marshmallows, do you? And she kind of looks at the little girl funny and is like, well, no, I really don't like the marshmallows. And right away, this little girl, we know something is off. You know. Almost immediately that something is going on here. Something is strange, because the girl tells her about a burn on her arm. And she's like, oh, but you've been hurt before. You got burned right below your elbow. And we see Helen look down and she's got a big scar. And it's real, like, zooms in, like, bum, 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 you know?
Yeah.
Real crazy, like.
And the girl acts kind of strange. It's almost, I think I was reminded of that episode when I watched The Bad Seed again.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's kind of the same kind of little girl acting. And even though in this, she's also really like kind of creepy, like in The Bad Seed, when in parts she just like, I don't know,
almost seems
almost
robotic.
Emotionless.
Yeah, she yeah. seems robotic in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And reminding me a little more of like Village of the Damned, the way those kids were soulless.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so she continues to talk to Helen, and then she out of nowhere is like, there's someone coming. I have to go. I have to leave. I'm going to go out the back door. You try to remember. And she's telling her, like, remember, telling her to remember things. And so we have Peter Seldon shows up, and he, again, just kind of comes right in. He's like, you mind if I come in for a minute? Explains to Helen that he had worked for her mother years ago. And he is kind of weird in the same way. You know, he's asking some very strange probing questions to Helen, and she's, I guess, you know, expectedly weirded out by the whole situation. She's like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, this is very bizarre. And so and the comment about him, though, he's like, I had a crush on you when you were a little girl. That was super gross.
that was creepy as hell. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh, what the fuck? Like, this is weird. And he then says, well, I have we forgot to mention he had seen her outside the school. And even the little girl, that's when she was like, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, she told her, remember. And then she said, yeah, I remember him from somewhere. And then, you know, shortly after he comes in and says, do you remember me? I saw you at the school. And okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to, you know, the horrible thing that happened, you just had some sort of a blackout, some kind of a psychotic break. And look, I have a picture of you when you were a little kid. and he pulls out the picture, which is super weird. Well, I guess, you know what, it's not, once we get to the end of this thing, why he would have that and why he was there to begin with.
Yeah.
But he shows the picture, and we realize that it's a picture of Marky, who is the little girl. She had said her name was Marky. That's what everybody called her.
And yeah, that was also something, like, at the very beginning, she says, everyone just calls me Marky. Mm-hmm. And, like, I at that moment, I already felt like, okay, it's probably her from the past. Because,
right.
because of, why wouldn't she say her real name, but say, like, everybody calls me Marky.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, and she sees the picture, and she's like, wait, that's the kid. Like, that's the kid who was just here. And then she hears her singing. The little girl is singing from off camera, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Mm-hmm. And she tells Peter, can't you hear it? Like, don't you hear? And he's like, what are you talking about? I don't hear anything. Like, I don't hear anything at all. And so Peter ends up leaving. We get Marky again, who tells her, or no, she didn't tell her. Yeah, she does tell her. I'm trying to remember exactly how it played out. I'm pretty sure Peter left her. Somehow they get back together out in the hallway. And just as you had said, she's like, I'm you, Helen. Like, I'm you. And Helen's now, she's sleeping, laying down on the couch, and starts to have a vision of what had happened when she was a child.
Yeah, and kind of flashbacks.
Yeah. And surprisingly for the Twilight Zone, I'm surprised they showed that. Even though it was in shadow, you know, we see the murder. You see, you know, him choke out. You see Peter choke out Helen's mother and then hit her over the head with some sort of a blunt object.
Yeah.
And now Helen is fully aware, and we get the confrontation between Peter and Helen where he tells her, like, your mom, something happened with the books, like, and your mom wasn't listening to what I had to say, and there was this thing happened. I didn't realize you were in the other room. Then I heard your scream, realized you black out, and I took off. All these years later, I'm coming to tie up loose ends.
Yeah, and, like, he is really, like, at first, because when he first got to her and talked to her a bit, like, it felt like he was just testing out the waters, but he wasn't, like, it wasn't gonna, like, say anything crazy or something. And then the next time he comes out and just flat out says it. Yeah, I did it. And even though you didn't remember, it was me. Yeah.
And then we have this fight between those two. And again, you know, they really, it was a good shot of him going down the stairs. Yeah. Like, where you see him kind of falling, tumbling, you know, feet overhead, all the way down these things. He dies. And then we get a little bit of exposition at the end. Everyone's already figured it out by this point. But we see her, and the detectives are like, oh, we gave her a sedative. It was almost like the end of Psycho, where you have the explanation of these. And to be fair, at this time, there wasn't an understanding of mental illness the way we understand it today. And memory regression in the way that it presented itself in her. You know, something was so far back and then was able to come to the surface. It was a self-defense mechanism to protect her in some way. Now, why this started happening before he even showed up to begin with, you know, it was like a crazy coincidence, but you only
saw him. She saw him.
Oh, yes, you're right. Yeah, you're
and
right.
And so she remembers, basically, yeah.
It's something jogged her memory.
Yeah, exactly. And when you just said, like, it's kind of like Psycho, where they explain the ending, I had to look it up, and this episode came out before Psycho, like, in the same year, but this was April, and Psycho seems to have been September, October of the
same
year.
Maybe Serling read Psycho, because the book was out a while before the movie.
Yeah, maybe.
So, yeah, maybe it was somewhere in his memory that he couldn't remember. Why does this seem so familiar?
And maybe he also, because, like, I had the wrong... Wait, didn't? Why did I think now I can't think of any words. Who did the music for Psycho? It was James Bernard.
Yes.
And so I for some reason had in my head that he also did the music for Twilight Zone, but no, that was
Jerry
Goldsmith.
Yeah, Jerry Goldsmith did that stuff.
Okay, I just got those two people confused. Yeah, okay, go on.
And okay, so we wrap up with, we hear the same singing coming from out in the hallway, the Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and all of that stuff going on, and she goes out there. She thinks this might be the same thing, but it turns out to be another little girl. It's a different little girl out there singing. And we see now that Helen, well, Marky is almost at peace with everything that had happened. She's okay with everything that had happened and having those memories back. She tells the little girl, you know, she has a great smile. Don't ever lose your smile, kid, or something like that. And the little girl's, oh, my dolly has a nice smile, too. And then we wrap up. That's the end of the episode. Overall, it's a good one, but it's really, as rewatching it, it felt like it might have been, it could have been an episode of Hitchcock Presents. It was kind of more of a you know, murder thriller that we didn't see as much in The Twilight Zone. You didn't see as much as the traditional kind of murder.
Yeah, it was different, but it was still enough of a Twilight Zone with the twist and the little girl, like
absolutely.
The whole psychic stuff coming back. So yeah, but yeah, you're right. It would have fit that as well.
It would have been in there. Yeah. So let's do the closing narration and we'll get on to the main topic for today.
Yes.
Miss Helen Foley, who has lived in night and who will wake up to morning. Miss Helen Foley, who took a dark spot from the tapestry of her life and rubbed it clean, then stepped back a few paces and got a good look at the Twilight Zone.
I love that we're just doing this like all throughout. Like
I know. It's never going to stop.
29 episodes and we did it every time.
Every single time, man. Every time. And we're going to probably continue to do it because that's just, it's I guess, fun. It's what we do now. Yeah. All right. So main topic for today. I had brought this one to the table because I had seen The Lighthouse and wanted to talk about it really bad. And Phil hadn't seen it yet. You had seen it in the theater. You were lucky.
I had
lucky.
Seen it before you had wanted to talk about it really bad.
And I didn't get a chance to see it in the theater, but I did get a chance to finally pick it up since it hit video on demand and watched it a few times since then and have been very excited to talk about this movie. Just really wanted to talk about that. And then I said, well, why don't we do just a Robert Eggers episode and talk about both? Because he really only has these two movies.
I just looked into his filmography. Like he did like a 27-minute short called Hansel and Gretel, which is, I could imagine him doing like a kind of grim fairy tale. That might be good. I got to see if I can find this. But what does it say? It's... it's in black and white, stylized. Like it's like his movies in general.
Yeah.
It's based on the classical expressionistic silent picture featuring detailed. It is a silent movie.
Oh, right on. I'm gonna see if I can find that. Yeah, because I'd like to see because it. He. So I saw The Witch in the theater. I was, when that first came out, I was very interested, and those are the two movies we're primarily going to talk about today, is The Witch, or The Vitch, if that's how you want to say it, from 2015, and then The Lighthouse just from last year. And what I liked about The Witch, just starting off, before we get into any of the, you know, details of the movie or anything like that, is that the full title is The Witch, A New England Folktale. And what he does so well, you know, he reminds me in some ways of Guillermo del Toro in that he tells these really dark, like del Toro for me has always been in a lot of ways like dark fairy tales, really dark fairy tales. And Eggers is more of your dark folk tales, like super old folk tales, you know, stuff that goes hundreds of years back. And The Witch really kicked off, I think, his career as far as becoming more of a mainstream director and getting the acclaim that I feel he deserves because I really like both of these movies. I think they're top-notch movies. And I can't wait to see what this guy does next because I feel like he's only doing things that he really wants to do and telling cool stories.
On his list for things to do next is, like, that's been in talks since he made The Witch, is Nosferatu.
Oh, yes.
A remake of that one. And I feel like his Nosferatu could be like,
amazing.
Really? Yeah.
Amazing. Because he captures the essence of what he's doing so well and the time period. Yeah. Like, he has a way of making you feel like you're right in this place. You know, nothing seems out of place. So let's start with The Witch. So as we mentioned, both of these are directed by Eggers, so we don't have to get into that.
And written by him, by the way, as well.
Yes, written by him as well. This is the first time I remember really seeing Anya Taylor-Joy.
This is her first movie, as far as I know.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I feel like I've looked this up like not too long ago, but this is, I'm pretty sure, like her first movie. This is what got her started.
You're right. She just did one TV episode, and then
that's it.
Yeah, and one uncredited in Vampire Academy. So The Witch, yeah. So I guess it's a good reason that it's the first time I noticed her, because it was her first movie.
since you see everything, you must have noticed her before if she was on TV, on movies before.
And she's one that I followed since seeing her in this, because she really is an amazing talent.
Yeah, she lives in the horror genre. Like, that's what she does most and what she does best, really.
Yeah, because, I mean, I would say probably the biggest thing she's done is maybe Glass.
Probably the biggest, as in...
As far as the biggest names, and then she did a lot of voice work, because she was Brea in the Dark Crystal Age of Resistance, but she was really good. And then one you and I both love is Thoroughbreds. I know
we even talked about on the show. Yeah,
we talked about, and it was amazing. She was in the most recent season of Peaky Blinders, which I thought she did a great job. And then she's got a ton of stuff. It looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things in post-production and 2 things that have been announced. So I'm glad, because I think she really is talented. And in this movie, she carries, I mean, so much of this movie on her shoulders.
She is the lead of this movie, and we follow her all throughout. What we should say right away, you already mentioned that it's a New England folk tale, and Robert Eggers, when he does something, he goes all out. So with this one, he actually looked into old tales, and also court. Things
documents.
That were written down, court documents, exactly, thank you, of the time, and took scenes and ideas from that about witch hunts, basically. And like, the whole movie is in an I've read of lots of people who watched the movie and couldn't understand what was being said, because it's in another kind of English.
It's a different dialect.
I gotta say, I watched this in the theater when it came out. I watched it in German, because we often have German dubs. And this is, I feel like, one movie where I'm glad that I watched a German dub, because even though, of course, I'm guessing I missed something by not hearing it in the delivery and like how it was supposed to be said. But they tried to do it in like old-timey German, but that's still really easy to understand.
Right.
So I could follow the plot without problems. And I think that was like one of the big problems for American audiences and, well, most of the world, I guess.
Yeah, most audiences.
Yeah.
And it is a tricky language. And I feel that was a lot of people's problem with the movie, was the dialect wasn't always easy. I was fortunate enough... In high school, I took a full year of Shakespeare, an entire year of Shakespeare. And a lot of it helped with at least the ye's and the thou's and, you know, thou art this and thou art that and ye this and ye that. And so for me, it wasn't an issue at all. I felt like I was fine. I understood everything they were talking about the entire time. But with this movie, I feel like you don't even need the dialogue and the movie would still work. Like, you could follow it along pretty easily for the most part, especially when it gets to some of the more visual stuff. You're like, holy shit, like, this is crazy. And so let's talk about the movie itself. And spoiler alert for both of these, we're going to talk about them pretty in depth. So if you haven't seen them, go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Oh, I was going to say, if you have not seen them, I would encourage you to watch them both before listening to us, because they're both very visceral and really make you feel... what is going on. But if you get to the end and you know what's coming, especially with both, I feel the endings really land well and kind of drive home what Eggers was trying to do with both of these things.
Yeah, but I also feel like in general there's so much else in these movies that if you haven't seen them and you're like really not in the mood to watch them right now, you can still listen to us and they still work, because there's so much going on there that it's not like one where if you know the twist ending, it's going to ruin it for you.
See, and I feel like with The Witch, it kind of might, because I did not see that ending coming. I feel like it could have went either way. I did not anticipate it was going to end like that. Whereas yeah, with the
it would take something away, but you would still enjoy
I think you would still
movie.
Enjoy it. Yeah, it's still really good. But the ending of The Witch. But okay, so let's start talking about The Witch. You know what? Anyone listening, you make up your mind. Whatever you want to do. If you want to get spoiled, we're going to spoil it. If not, check out the movies. So we open up in 1630s New England. You have a plantation of settlers who are, I think we almost open up right in the church. And
I think so. And they are, and we're like basically having like a talk that the main family of the movie is being thrown out of the town.
Yeah.
And what they get to do, I think what they are allowed to do anymore and what they can take with them, I think that it's like a big enough talk. And then pretty soon they're like out of the town in like a house, like just outside of the walls of
and
the,
they get
of the
they
town.
Get kicked out for being too religious was their thing, is he was almost chastising the church for their practices. And what was her dad? William was her dad's name. What's his name? Ralph Einson? Is that how you'd say it? I-N-E-S-O-N?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, maybe it's innocent. I don't know, kind of.
Not sure. But anyways, he is standing up in front of the church, pretty much telling them they're not doing things right. And the church is like, hey, man, like, you got to go. And he says, well, I'll gladly go. Like, I'll take my family and God will be good to us outside. Like, we really don't need you. And this was a time in the world where you did need that, though, for the most part. You needed the community in order to survive. It was hard to survive on your own. And so they pack everybody up into the wagon. So you've got Tomlinson, who is played by Anya Taylor-Joy. You have Caleb, who's the kind of the middle child, because you have the two younger ones. I don't know if they were twins. I think they were twins.
I think so as well, yeah.
Yeah, so you've got Caleb, Mercy and Jonas, who are the twins, and then Samuel, the baby. So there's a little tiny baby, you know, just born, newborn baby. So they're going off, and they're going to build themselves a place to live. They're going to have a place to live, start farming, do all of that stuff that comes along with trying to survive on your own. And the biggest thing that happens to us where you realize something bad is going on is Anya Taylor-Joy is playing with Samuel outside. She's got the baby in front of her and she's playing peekaboo, like traditional peekaboo, you know, covering her face and then, surprising the baby. She does that like twice. And then on the third time, there's just no baby there. She's in an open area to where you wouldn't think, you know, in the blink of an eye, somebody could have come up, snatched this baby and been gone.
Yeah, exactly. And then she looks like, I feel if I remember it correctly, she looks like to the left and we just see like a bit of the bushes shaking as if someone just ran through there.
Yeah.
But like it must have been in the blink of an eye because really she did a peek-a-boo and opened her eyes and the kid was gone. And it was shot really well where like we would see when she closed her eyes, we would see her face. And when she doesn't, we see the baby and then suddenly there's just the empty crib. It's so well done.
And it was so creepy too. So creepy.
Yeah. And by the way, I said that to you before we started, but I haven't seen this movie since it came out in 2015. Yet this is one of those movies where I can still remember most of the things that happened. And like I still have these pictures in my head of her looking to the left and the bushes shaking.
Yeah.
You know, this was like 5 years ago by now.
It was a well-done scene. It was really well done. And this throws the family into a state of panic. So Caleb and William go out and they're going to look for the baby. And William's explaining it away as a wolf. They're like, it could have been a wolf. It could have been any of these things. He's been out there looking and looking and looking. There's no sign of the baby whatsoever. And her mother, Catherine, played by Kate Dickey, is, I don't know, almost, I don't want to say frantic because she's beyond that. She's in like an intense state of shock where she just doesn't get out of bed. She just prays all day. And that's everything that she can do. And we also see the elements are now against our family. Like the crops aren't really coming in the way they're supposed to. He has to trade off her father's silver cup, his wife's silver cup, in order to just kind of keep the family going in some way.
Yeah, and this was So maybe I remember this wrong, but this is after some time after they got kicked out. They were doing pretty well outside. Yeah. And then after the baby was gone, this kind of, the tides changed.
Yeah, because it took them some time to get everything growing, to get the corn growing and all of that stuff. And we see Caleb and William out in the woods after the baby was gone. And Caleb wasn't supposed to be out in the woods at all. And his dad takes him out there. They're going to shoot a rabbit. Don't end up getting the rabbit. Really creepy looking rabbit, too.
Yeah.
Like not a normal, what you think of like a bunny. Hey, soft, nice bunny. Really strange looking rabbit. And oh, we forgot the whole like really intense sequence of we see the witch who took the baby.
I was wondering if that happened at that point or a bit later on. Yeah, that's like a scene that I especially didn't expect in this kind of movie because even though it's kind of, there's always a feeling, is there really a witch or is something else going on? We also, at the same time, while still feeling this all throughout the movie, very early on, we get a scene where the witch kills the baby and
bathes in its blood.
Bathes in its blood, exactly, yeah. And that scene is fucked
up. It reminded me of that scene from Haxan. Like, it was almost the same. Do you remember that when we watched that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was the baby being like held up by its legs and stuff like that. But and the witch in this instance is an older woman, very, you know,
we don't see her face, but she's kind of I feel like from the body, very much like the witch in the Left 4 Dead games.
Oh yeah. Yeah, similar.
That's kinda like kind of bent a bit, saggy, the spine is looking out.
Saggy really. Skin heavier set, real saggy skin and very, what you would think of, kind of if you were to say a witch, you know, kind of an old in the woods, like, creepy. Yeah,
she's just completely naked, bathing in a baby's blood.
And it's fucked up, man.
We see it all, and this is like early on in the movie, but I feel like no one's talking about that with that movie.
Yeah.
Because there's so much and it's crazy.
There's a lot that's still coming. But so we know there is something in the woods, but at this point you don't know if it's a witch or not, or just some crazy old lady, but it's hard to explain away how fast the baby disappeared because the baby was gone so quickly. And then we get Mercy and Jonas. So and we do see Caleb in this really, you know, it's kind of a coming of age thing for him as well. Like he's kind of looking at his sister while he's sleeping, like kind of like peeking down her shirt a little bit. And so he's coming into puberty while all this is going on. And so we've got Thomason is down by the water, you know, washing the clothes or whatever it is. Caleb's down there with her. And then Mercy and Jonas show up and they're like, oh, Black Phillip told us that the baby was taken by a witch and you're a witch. And they start saying all this stuff. And then Thomason goes on to tell both of them, like, maybe I am a witch and I'm going to send you to hell and I'm going to do all this stuff, like all these horrible things to these two kids. And they get really freaked out and like, hey, if you tell mom and dad, like, you're going to get it. Like, I'm going to get you. And Caleb is weirded out by all of it. He's like, stop. What are you talking about? She's like, I'm just joking. Like, it's, you know, it's nothing. Don't worry about it.
And that's so relatable because that's what I would totally do with like these little children, you know. But
because they both are a little pain in the asses, like they're
throughout, and like they're always talking to Black Phillip, and Black Phillip is the best character.
Yeah, so Black Phillip is a goat that they have on the farm, and he's a solid black goat, and they continue throughout the movie to say like Black Phillip told us this or Black Phillip told us that, and so things now, you know, they continue to go bad, and the mom's still in a bad way. The dad's trying to keep everything together, and Caleb Thomason finds Caleb getting ready to go out into the woods one morning, and she's like, well, you got to take me with you. Like, I'm gonna tell mom and dad if you don't at least take me with you so I can help keep you safe, or whatever the case may be. So they're out in the woods together and get separated, and Caleb then gets drawn to this place in the woods. He finds this hut in the woods, and we see this woman.
Totally forgot the scene. Yeah.
We see this woman come out now, who's very beautiful, like a gorgeous, you know, huge boobs just pushed way up in this like brassiere thing, which I think played so well, and it was important because that's what he was going through at the time. Like that was her seduction for him, and he's just drawn to this woman. She goes down to kiss him, and then all we see is this gnarly old hand, like very The Shining, you know, yeah. almost like wet and rotted. And we see this hand grab him by the back of the head. Anya Taylor-Joy takes off, goes back home, and now they're on the look for Caleb. And William, the father, he's panicking. He's like, oh, shit, you know, what do I do? Like, we don't even have a horse because they lost the horse, so he can't ride back to town. So they weren't too close to town because he said it would have been, like, at least a day's ride on the horse, but it would take him 2 days to get help, to go find people to help him go search the woods for Caleb. And he's getting ready to take off. Catherine's panicking. She's like, you can't leave us. Because in her mind, like, what would they do? You know, without yeah. him, he cuts all the firewood. He does all of this stuff.
And he cuts lots of firewood.
Oh, shit. They had a ton of firewood out there. And he cuts all the firewood up. And just as he's getting ready to, like, take off anyway, and this is where he admits it, like, I sold your cup. I'm the one who took Caleb out into the woods to begin with. And she's now even more distraught. Like, why would you lie to me about all these things? And not long after, Caleb shows back up. He's just naked outside, shivering in the rain. And they bring him inside, and then we get this whole crazy... That scene is intense when they're all up in the attic with Caleb laying down.
Basically an exorcism scene.
Yeah, kind of like an exorcism, but when the two little kids start panicking, when Jonas and Mercy, because they're like, everybody pray over Caleb, and he spits out an apple. She's like, open his jaws up. So the dad puts a knife in his mouth and like cracks his jaw open, and then he yeah. throws up this apple, and then he goes down for a little bit. Then they're all around him praying, you know, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. But Jonas and Mercy are like, we can't say our prayers. They start acting crazy. Like, something's really wrong with them. And as the viewer, you're like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, is there really some crazy evil in this world? In this, their world anyway? Or what are these two kids doing? And then they just fall on the floor and stop talking. You know, they're just yeah. out. They're down for the count. And Caleb then, and the actor, what was his name? Harvey Scrimshaw? Looks like Scrimshaw?
Yeah, Harvey Scrimshaw, yeah.
So he gives this really cool performance, though, where he, like, chest raises all the way up, and he's talking like, oh, I see you. Like, I see you, God. You're there, and it's beautiful. Like, take me in your arms. And this is very, like you said, an exorcism almost.
Yeah.
And then the
kid was really good, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, like, yeah, his performance was, movie. Yeah. Oh, you're right. He was good through all of it, but that performance was standout for him for being yeah. such a young kid. And then he falls over and he's done. And now everybody's just like, what is going on here? And the two kids, Jonas and Mercy, are still, you know, don't talk, don't anything. And that's where Anya Taylor-Joy is like, it's them two. Like, they're the ones who are doing this. Like, they're all fucked up pretending to be this. And so the dad finally loses his shit, and William's like, well, I'm going to take this fucking kid and go do something crazy. I don't remember what he said. Like, I'm going to take him outside and figure out if he's a witch or not. And then both of them are like, ah, no, we're pretending. Like, this is all just make-believe. We're so sorry. And so...
Which is kind of crazy that these kids are dead evil. Like,
right. Yeah, they were really bad kids. But at the same time, they were just kids. Like, they had no realization of the severity of everything that was going on around them. Yeah. And so Anya Taylor-Joy has a talk with her dad, and she calls him out on everything. She's like, you know, so much of this is you. Like, you're sitting there, you're a hypocrite. You're telling me to be a super godly person, but you're the one that sold the cup. You're the one that lied to mom. You're the one that did this. And he's like, don't let the devil talk through you, kid. And then boards all these kids up out in the stable. Yeah. Like, yeah.
You got to add, I think you didn't say that they blamed Thomason on selling the cup and like
oh, yeah, yeah,
doing
yeah.
all the things. And like, even though the dad did it, he blamed her a lot for a lot of things.
Yeah, like he didn't own up to it, what was actually yeah. happening. And so he then faults her and says it's the devil inside her. Don't let the devil use thy lips to speak upon thy father that way, or something like that. And he throws all three kids out in this little stable and just boards it up. And so you've got the three kids, there's a cow out there with them. And then I want to say, I don't think Black Phillip was in there with him. He might have been. But I can't remember.
I think he was in another shed, like across. Like they could see him, but they couldn't get to him.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, he was in some sort of a pen or something like that. But that's not the big important part of this scene anyway, because this is another just nightmare scene where you've got the kids who are out there. It is now nighttime, and we see the witch over there like milking the cow. Like, you only see her again. You only see from behind her. You don't really see her face. Yeah. But then she turns around, and this woman is just, I mean, terrifying. She really is a terrifying creature. And so the following morning, he hears all the screaming and everything that goes down out there. And he goes out. Or no, that same night was the mom, right? I want to say the same thing.
I think with the crow, right?
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, you tell that.
Yeah, so... The mom starts having visions of, well, not even really visions, but Caleb is now back. And Caleb talks to her. They have this conversation about, you know, wouldn't you love to have me back? Or something. I don't remember the exact dialogue. But essentially, he's bringing her into some form of a contract. Like, you know, all you have to do is this. And then we get this fucking awful nightmare image of the mother sitting in a rocking chair in the middle of the room. Maybe not a rocking chair, but just a chair. She's sitting in a chair in the middle of a room with a crow pecking at one of her exposed nipples.
Yeah, like almost like she's breastfeeding. Crow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's blood like just running down all, and while she's sitting there smiling and laughing. And that's what makes it so crazy.
Yeah, really euphoric that basically she got her kid back is like the way she acts. Yeah.
The way she's seeing it, yeah, she's got her loves back, but the way we see it is there's a crow just eating away at her breast, and it's so uncomfortable and just painful. It's one of those scenes that's like painful to watch. You can feel it.
To even think about it hurts. Yeah. So I don't know at what point this happened in the movie, but I feel it wasn't some super tense scene, but there was one scene in the movie that really messed with it made me laugh out loud in the cinema, because it was all this tension. And yeah, there was the scene, the music swelled up, there was all this tension, then the music stopped and it cut to Black Phillip's face. And I'm not sure what scene that was, but maybe you remember. It wasn't...
No, I don't remember specifically, but we do get a lot of shots of Black Phillip. Yeah. You know, they lead you to believe that something is going on with this goat. Like, there is something happening with this goat. And so we see the mom... Oh, so bad. So gross. And she then has a confession, or she had a confession before this, like... I used to be so close to God and have such a strong faith, but all that's gone since Samuel's gone. And so I think that was part of her leading into this scene with the crow. And then we have the dad the night before while the kids are still out in the stable. I think it was like a stable type area, having his confession to God. And, you know, don't do this to my family. Like, take me. It was my fault. I was the liar. I was a fool with pride. I let all this stuff get in the way of my eyes. And they've had conversations throughout as well, saying, I just want to go home. And he's like, go home where? They do make a plan to leave. Like, they're going to leave and go back to the plantation. She's like, I want to go home to England. You know, I want to be back somewhere safe. And so back to where the kids are at. The next morning, the dad goes out there and the boards are all blown off. The two kids are dead. Mercy and Jonas are both dead. And Anya Taylor-Joy is just out there all fucked up. Like, there was this woman there. Like, it's true. There was a witch. And then you get this huge shock scene where out of nowhere, Black Phillip just spears William. Like, yeah. I mean, horns right through his abdomen. Just two just horns.
Into the wall.
Out of nowhere, too. And then I don't know who trained that goat, but they did a good job because he's like rearing up on hind legs.
Yeah.
And really huge horns, too. You know, this isn't a goat with no horns. He's got big horns. And so now we've got the father bleeding out on the ground. And Anya Taylor-Joy is now, I mean, really in a state of shock. And then out of nowhere, the mom comes out. And she's a lunatic. Like, this is all on you. She's very disheveled. Her hair is all down now. She's in like a nightgown of sorts.
Yeah.
And then she's going to try and kill Anya Taylor-Joy, but then Anya Taylor-Joy ends up killing her mother and being the only person left. And we get a fade to black right there, which I thought that was where the movie was going to end, or we would just leave with that image of Anya Taylor-Joy, you know, covered in blood or something like that, that it was going to be a little more obscure. But no, that's not the end of this movie. And we get Anya Taylor-Joy after the fact. She sits and she talks to Black Phillip. She's like, you know, if you can really talk, then you need to talk to me. Like, I'm calling you out. If you have the ability to talk. And when I saw this movie in the theater, I did not expect to hear Black Phillip's voice.
Me neither. No.
Yeah. Like, I expected this to just, you know, she was going to try and talk to him and realize it was like, it was, or for us, maybe it had just all been cabin fever. Like, we don't really know her. There was this crazy woman who lived in the woods, but she was just a crazy woman who lived in the woods. And, but then we hear Black Phillip's voice out of nowhere. We don't see his face talking. We hear him off screen talking to her. And you get that great line, you know, do you want to live deliciously? And he asks her, like, what do you want? You want a pretty dress? You want to see the world? There's a book behind you. All you have to do is sign my book. And she tells him, like, I can't. I don't know how to write my name. Like, she was never taught how to write. And he says, well, I'll guide your hand. Like, now disrobe. And we see her walking, real great shot, a real good long shot of her kind of walking across the field towards the woods. And we get to the woods and we see this fucking witch ritual where you've got all these witches, you know, very animalistic and feral almost out in the woods dancing and violently moving their bodies back and forth, which if that wasn't bad enough, then you get, they all just start floating away. Like they're all floating up into the sky. And we get one last shot on Anya Taylor-Joy's face, real close to her face. And she, you can kind of see the background moving behind her a little bit, but you see the smile come across her face. And that leads me to believe that that was Black Phillip's intention the entire time, was just to get to her. It wasn't about anybody else. He wanted just her. This woman who had just come into adulthood. Oh, and we forgot that the parents talked about selling her off, like getting rid of her. And getting rid of her back into the village. And then we see her float away, and that's when we get the actual end of the movie.
Yeah, and the whole thing with write your name in my book, that's kind of interesting because that's something we don't hear much about witches these days. In modern stories, it's often like something completely else. But that was the thing at the time, was you wrote your name in the book of the devil, and that made you a witch, and you said you will follow him. And and so Black Phillip in the end wasn't just like a goat. He was basically the devil.
He was the devil himself. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm going to look really quick, because what I always liked about this movie is it felt so different than a lot of horror movies of the time. And I'm going to look up real fast just to see what else we had around in 2015. You know, just some comparative stuff. So you had Insidious Chapter 3, Crimson Peak, which I really enjoyed. Hashtag Horror, it wasn't terrible. It wasn't the worst thing I ever seen, but it wasn't the best. Krampus came out that year. Maggie, did you ever see Maggie with Arnold
Maggie
Schwarzenegger? Yeah, it's real good. Bone Tomahawk, an amazing movie. But even some of the other stuff like Sinister, Final Girls, Deathgasm, Paranormal Activity, The Ghost Dimension, The Lazarus Effect, Tales of Halloween, The Poltergeist remake, Green Room, Southbound. Southbound was solid. Yeah. The Visit, which I actually like. I feel like that was Shyamalan's return to form, was with The Visit. A Christmas
it
Horror Story.
As good as the before things, but yeah.
What else we got? Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, The Invitation, Baskin. Baskin was a fucking nightmare. That was another one, but I think that kind of went unseen for the most part.
I still haven't seen it.
It's good, but it really is. Like, it really feels like hell. Like, if you went to hell, that is what it would be like.
Sounds fun.
I Spit on Your Grave 3, and you might be able to find Baskin, because it's...
On Shudder over here. I got to look into that again.
Yeah, it's been on a few. Human Centipede 3.
That's the best one.
Right, of all of them. Got that Eric Roberts in there. So you look at everything else that came out that year, though. You had some stuff that we had kind of seen before, but this felt like, I don't know, it just felt so different than everything else.
I feel like this was maybe the start of the things that later went on to be called like post-horror. These kind of horror movies that like that the artsy people really like, the art house horror, that like we got some more those more recently. Well, of course, The Lighthouse. Also, yeah. What else? What like that Casey Affleck one, Ghost Story, I think.
Oh,
is the name.
Yeah. Yeah, that like, was different.
Like these kind of movies, and this was like a front runner for those. Like it was a horror movie, but it was way more art house. It was something that wasn't for the wide masses really to see. It was for fans or for movie critics and horror fans.
Right. Yeah. Like, no, I think you're right.
He didn't care what anyone thought. I feel like he made this movie in this old-timey English because that's what he wanted to do and that's what made sense to him. He didn't think, no one will understand this, people will get mad. No, he just made it because, yeah, he had a vision, basically.
Yeah. So The Witch, though, I highly recommend. Highly recommend. It is, you know, as many times I saw it in the theater and I've watched it probably 3-4 times since its release on video on demand. And upon rewatching it, and the great thing about The Witch is it's never going to age.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing in it. There's no, even, I mean, the special effects with the flying, most of it looked like it was done on wires. So it's not weird CGI. It could have been, but it's from so far away that you don't really see the CGI if that's how it was done.
Yeah, it was just in the background, basically. We didn't see like full on them flying away. It was really mostly from far off. And yeah, the movie will never age for sure. And it's what I really like about the movie is the tension it builds, like all throughout. Like there isn't that much happening all throughout the movie. There are some gruesome scenes, but there's like two set pieces. But there's always tension through the music, through how it's shot, and you always feel kind of on the edge. And that's why there was this one scene where I don't think much happened, but I was already on the edge, and then the music stopped and it cut to Black Phillip, and I had to laugh because suddenly there's this goat face, and it felt like, it felt really weird, and I just had to get rid of that tension.
Right.
And that's how this movie works really effectively, is as a horror movie, it actually makes you like feel tense and like on the edge of your seat, scared what's going to happen.
You don't really know what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it all feels very real world. Like this could really be happening somewhere.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to move on to the next one since we're already coming up on an hour, which I don't know how that's possible. I know. I don't know.
I felt like, we're only going to talk about two movies today. So it's going to be a chill episode.
Yeah. 25-minute episode.
For Rammstein because we had some time.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. So the next movie up came out at the end of last year, came out in November. You got to see it in the theater. I was bummed I did not, just based on the three names on it. Roger Eggers, Willem Pattinson, Willem Dafoe. I'm looking at a picture of both of them right now. Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. And this one is, of course, The Lighthouse. And this, unlike The Witch, which I feel gave us a very clear-cut story, this one is just wrapped up in obscurity and ambiguity on so many different levels. But I'm not I was never upset about that. Was never upset about that throughout the entirety of this movie. And as I had mentioned, Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe are really our only two characters in this movie. You get a mermaid for a little bit. But really, you just have these two guys, and that's about it. And you want to talk about sound design? Holy shit! Like that foghorn going off all the time, like it used it so well.
Yeah, this movie is just so great, and I wanted to talk about it for so long. Now let's get right into
all
it.
Right.
Like, it starts off.
Go ahead.
I feel like it starts off with like Robert Pattinson arriving at.
Though it's both of them arriving together.
Oh, yeah, right. Because they arrive together and Robert Pattinson basically goes around the lighthouse. But the house beside the lighthouse and like learns where he's going to live for the next, for the longest time. I think he hits his head on the way upstairs because
he does.
The wall's too tiny. And
Willem Dafoe immediately starts farting.
Yeah, he starts there and he doesn't stop until the end.
No, throughout the whole movie. So they're two guys who, and you know, before we get into a ton of the plot, this again deals with a lot of really old folklore. You know, and me, I think I like this one so much more, partially because it deals with maritime and sailors. And that's a history that I'd learned while being in the Navy. And you talk, and you know that feeling of, you know, kind of being one with the ocean. You're out there for 45 days at a time, 30 days at a time. That's a long time to be out on the water. And these old sailors, you know, this is a long time before, because this is set at the turn of the century. It's like 1890, somewhere in there. And so you had all these old sea stories of, you know, mermaids and Poseidon and seagulls. There was a story for everything, you know, why the weather would do what the weather did. And so these two guys are going to go man a lighthouse for 4 weeks. It's their turn. It's like a rotation of duty. They go out there, they man the lighthouse for 4 weeks, then they'll come get picked up, and then they'll be taken back to the mainland after earning their keep. And so you're right. Then we jump into Pattinson is trying to figure out how he's going to navigate this thing. He's a hard worker, but we see really quick that Defoe is kind of stuck in that old-time belief system, and he's a dick through most of this movie. Like, he really is a dick, and he's always telling them, like, come on, lad. And it's important to note, though, that right at the beginning, we see that Pattinson doesn't drink booze. That's his big thing. And Defoe's big thing is, you're going to do all the work, and I'm going to man the light. Like, that's my spot up there.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting is that we don't, of course, get any exposition. We just start in, like, they get there. We see these two people get there. But really quickly, we see that Defoe is the older one. He's the boss. And yeah, he's bossing him around pretty quickly. And, like, they're having the first dinner together. And like he fills his he fills both glasses with rum, I think.
Yeah,
and
some like kind of booze.
Wants Pattinson to drink it as well. And Pattinson said, "No, I don't drink." He pulls it off and fills it with water. And you already see Willem Dafoe. It felt weird because he felt kind of like he was okay with that, and that didn't feel like the character even for those few minutes we saw him so far. And yeah, then Pattinson drinks the water, and it's also really like disgusting.
Yeah, he spits
it out.
And Defoe's laughing at him. He's laughing right in his face. Like, you got to clean the pipes there, boy. That's part of the reason why we're here. And both of these men, I am so pissed that they got snubbed at the Oscars for these performances. Yeah,
they both deserved Oscars. Like, I think we even talked about it on the show that you said a few times that you'd want them to both be nominated for Best Actor.
Yeah, but I think after rewatching it, I would want Pattinson Best Actor and Defoe Supporting.
Yeah, so they both could
Pattinson,
win.
Yeah, well, so they could both win, but also Pattinson gets a lot more screen time than Defoe. Yeah. We see Pattinson a lot on his own and his struggles as he really gets shit on. And we also see Defoe right from the beginning when they're at that dinner scene, bringing back these kind of old world superstitions and traditions. He's like, well, it's bad luck not to toast on this. And then the following night is when he tells him, well, it's bad luck to kill a seabird. And that's when he throws the fucking thing across the wall at Pattinson. And you realize that Defoe's kind of crazy. Like, he's like, you don't kill a fucking seabird. And he's like, oh, don't mind me. I'm just an old man. Yada, like, tries to kind of backtrack a little bit with all of that. Oh, and we do got to say that right at the beginning of the movie, we see Pattinson finds that little mermaid carving.
Oh, yeah, in the
which plays
the
a big
mattress.
Role. Yeah, which plays a big role throughout all of this. And so now, for the first probably 20, 30 minutes, we just see Pattinson really, I mean, he's doing hard manual labor all day long, nonstop.
Yeah, and like even like lots of like useless things that he then is told by Willem Dafoe, like when he has this big oil
drum
that he carries up the whole lighthouse. Then he is at the top of the thing, and Willem Dafoe's like, well, next time just use this little can to transport it,
and he's
and
like,
I'll
catch,
bring that thing back down.
Right? He tells him, like, catch your breath, lad, catch your breath. And then he's like, now take that all the way back downstairs. And it's not a straight shot either; it's a spiral staircase all the way up to the top of the lighthouse.
Yeah, which is it feels it feels hard just watching. Like I got tired watching him do all this work. In fact, I could never do this even for like a week.
And we should mention that this is shot in a 4:3 aspect ratio.
Yeah,
like
and in black and white.
Yeah, beautiful black and white. The cinematography was gorgeous. But yeah, so most people might be confused as to why it's just a square on the frame. Or I don't know if it's even 4:3. I don't know what the actual aspect ratio is. But it's its aspect ratio is 119:1. But you get, it's a square image. It's not a full image, which I think also works really well.
Yeah, it really shows us how they are like pressed into that box.
Yeah.
And it's really just a small frame where they're all sitting together all the time.
Yeah, it's very confined, very claustrophobic, which lends itself well to the space that they're in. And it's not long before Pattinson has his first nightmare of the mermaid, where he's walking out. And it's a really cool image, the way the water opened up. Like it almost split in half, and he sees this thing out in the water. He starts walking towards it until the point where his head is completely submerged, and we hear the singing underwater. It was almost like Harry Potter, where they had to open the thing underwater in order to hear it. And he gets under there, and he hears, like this siren almost, you know, not really a mermaid, but more of a siren. And then he sees her. He starts to... I don't remember if he gets really close to her, but he wakes up with water dripping onto his face. And that's like Defoe yelling at him, like, gotta fix the shingles, boy. Get up there and put some shingles on her, lad. He always called him lad.
Lad.
And then he's always, every time Defoe's on screen, he's farting.
Yeah.
Which really works, though, when you get to the end of this, how it all plays out.
And yeah, for sure.
So they've been there a few weeks now, and Pattinson, which I thought was a really good scene, Pattinson tries to stand up to Defoe, and because he's like, get down here, lad, get down here. And he's like, what's that? And he points to a spot on the ground. And that's when Defoe just loses his shit on him. And he's like, I swabbed that better. And this is better than the Queen's Palace in England or whatever. It couldn't be any better than that. He's like, well, I tell you to do it fucking again, you're going to do it fucking again. If I tell you to pull every single nail out of this fucking place and suck the rust off all of them till they sparkle like a whale's pecker, you're going to do it and then rebuild it, and you're going to do it with a fucking smile on your face. Like, he really just, and Pattinson's just like, holy shit, man. Like, what am I in right now? Like, what is going on?
Yeah, Defoe really always like switches between like being kind of like funny old man and being like the worst boss you could ever have.
Yeah.
And like he goes all out, and he goes on rants, and there's gonna come up a rant at the end. That's just the best thing ever.
So good.
But all throughout, like, he's always either like making jokes, saying don't be too strict, and like really like, because Pattinson says that he doesn't want to drink because drinking is
not
allowed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Defoe says, fuck the rules, basically. And like,
And we do see Pattinson getting harassed by seagulls throughout a lot of this. Because that leads up to a really intense moment where he murders that seagull. And shit, man. Like, I don't know what prop company made that seagull, but they did a good job. Because the feathers coming off, the splatter, the way it went really. And it was after he fell out of the. So that thing he was hanging on over the side of the lighthouse when he was painting, that's called a bosun's chair. And I used to actually hang in one of those and paint the side of the ship. And it is scary. Like, you're only on a plank of wood held up by a piece of rope. And so Pattinson's up there painting, and Defoe's manning the top. And he's like, I'm the greatest one who could ever man this thing. Don't worry about me.
And then he falls down.
It ends up breaking. He's like, stop wiggling, boys. Stop wiggling. And it ends up breaking. Pattinson falls down to the ground. He's laying on his back. And that's where you've got the, again, the seagulls show up. But we reach this point where he murders the seagull. And it is brutal. Like, he goes out to the shithole, opens it up. And then he sees one dead seagull in there. The other one lands next to him on the actual frame of the little, I guess just where it's almost like a septic tank where you just throw all your shit and disgusting stuff. And the seagull lands there and then starts attacking him, like pecking at him. And
it really feels like it's mocking him. Yeah. And then after, like, of course it has to happen that way. He was told by Willem Dafoe to not kill a seagull.
Right.
And not only does he kill a seagull, he does it in the most brutal way ever by actually grabbing it by the neck and slamming it onto the onto this thing until it's you see the like you said, you see the blood splatter on the surface, and he's just like beating the shit out of that bird.
And he beats it for a good like probably 30 seconds. We watch him just thrash this seagull.
It's so long that it really gets uncomfortable to watch because it gets worse and worse, and you think, just let it go.
Yeah, like, stop. What are you? It's dead. I promise you that thing is dead.
Yeah.
Like, and
it
I
was
did
that 10 minutes ago.
I like in that scene, though, that right after he murders that bird, we hear a bunch of seagulls all over the island really start to vocalize, I guess, loudly. I don't know how else to put it. They start getting really loud. And so it's almost their response to him doing that. So it makes you as the audience member like, you know, okay, are we going that route? Like, are there spirits of dead sailors in all of these birds? Or what is the case?
Yeah, and Defoe said, by the way, that that's the case, that it's the spirits of dead sailors in the birds, and that's why you don't kill them. And also, does he say that they bring bad weather?
No, he's
bad luck.
No, he makes the comment once the weather does start the turn. He's like, it's because you killed that gull. That's what's bringing these bad winds. And Pattinson, throughout all of this, just continues to get the shitty jobs. We do see him see the mermaid one time on the beach. She's, or not on the beach, but on the rocks. She's up there. She looks like she's passed out, and he's touching her breasts and being weird. You see this really weird, like, fish vagina, half fish, half human vagina, on right below her belly button.
Isn't that always like the fun conversation of like, what half of a mermaid would you want to be the fish?
Right.
And like, well, here's like the best of both worlds, I guess.
What was that really weird fucking movie I watched? The Lure. Did you watch The Lure?
Not yet. I really want to see that. That's the horror musical.
Yeah, with mermaids, where they didn't have any genitals at all. They were just, it was very bizarre. When they were in the human form, but when they were in the fish form, they did. Which is super strange. It's a good movie, though. It was interesting. So we get closer to the end of their stint there. And so now we've seen some of the kind of supernatural things happen. Like I said, we saw the mermaid, and we've seen Pattinson kind of fantasizing about the mermaid. He's masturbating like feverishly,
before he saw the mermaid that, like just like with the little wooden
the
figure.
Little that's wooden like figure. His, yeah, that's yeah. That's his pornography, I guess. Very strange. And so now we're getting really close to the end of their stint there. It's only going to be like a day or two more. Defoe still hasn't let him up in the lighthouse, tells him he's never going to let him up. He can't work the light. That's his thing. And did we already, get the vision with the tentacles in that?
Sorry, I didn't hear you. The internet cut off for a second.
Yeah, did we already get that weird vision with the tentacles when Pattinson was looking up through the slots?
Oh, I'm not sure about that one, but we for sure got a scene before that where one of the few scenes that Pattinson isn't in, where we see Willem Dafoe just laying outside on the lighthouse completely naked and just staring at the light, and like then it zooms out and we see it from afar. And like we got that before that, and so there seems to be something about the light. And I think the tentacle stuff happens there as well, because pretty soon we're getting
Before he was drinking.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we see Pattinson go up to the lighthouse at night, go up to the light. He's in the lighthouse. He goes up to the light, but it's locked from the inside, but it's a slotted floor. It's like an iron, you can see through it. There's holes in it. And he can hear Defoe almost. It feels like he's moaning in like a sexual manner, like there's some sort of sex going on up there, some sort of pleasure happening. And then this fucking goo starts dripping down through the slots, and you're like, oh, gross. Like, you know, is he masturbating? Like, is that semen falling down through these slots in the floor? And Pattinson continues to watch, and then a whole bunch of this goo comes down, and you see Pattinson like, wait, this doesn't seem right. And then you just see these huge tentacles go sliding across the grated floor, which is really, and they look good too. Like it was, I don't know if that was all CGI. I'm unsure, But you see that stuff.
It looked really realistic. Yeah,
yeah, it looked good. And then Pattinson kind of freaks out. So right,
as you would.
As you would. And right before they go to leave, he's like, you got to have a drink with me. He's like, we're getting ready to get off this rock. Even if the inspector was here, he wouldn't be mad about us having a drink together. And they start having drinks really fast, like three right in a row. Boom, boom, boom. Pattinson's just knocking them back. And these guys now form a bond over booze. And this is where shit really gets crazy. This is where the movie went off the rails. Like, if it wasn't already bad enough, this is where everything goes just bonkers.
Yeah, they are just going completely nuts. Like, laughing, joking, singing,
crying,
talking, dancing, crying. Yeah. Yeah, they're going through all the emotions. And we only see, like you would maybe remember a night like that the day after. We just see, like, snippets of what's happening.
And oh, so gross when Pattinson has to empty the bedpans, though. Like, and you see the bedpans are just full of piss and shit. Like, yeah, floating turds. And so he's walking out. The storm is now... Or wait, that was after. That was after. They don't get picked up. They think they're going to get picked up. But he's like, well, we just got too drunk the night before and we must have missed the first ferry. And Defoe's like, no, this storm is bad. Like, there was a guy who was stranded here for this long. It might be good on the mainland, but it's going to be bad here. So they continue on drinking night after night, ever since they should have gone home. And Pattinson has to empty these bedpans that are so gross, goes to throw them off the rock face, and all the turds and piss just fly back right into his, like, mouth.
Yeah. Just it's so disgusting. And, yeah, then they're partying on every night. And then there's, I don't know, at what point was it where it was actually, like, we weren't sure if they were there for two more weeks or 2 days.
Yeah, so it had been a couple of weeks. Well, we don't know. We don't know if it had been days or weeks. But at one point, Defoe tells Pattinson, he says, hey, we have to ration. Like, we've got a ration. He's like, what do you mean ration? We'll be gone soon. He's like, it's been 2 weeks since we were supposed to go. And Pattinson is still acting like it was just yesterday that they were supposed to go.
And that's kind of what was implied to us as well as the viewer. Like, it didn't really feel like, well, of course, it's a movie. It never feels like that much time passes. But also, there was no indication that they were there for that long. They just showed like one more night or something, I think.
Yeah, and they continue having a good time, partying, drinking. More weird shit keeps happening. Pattinson breaks the little wooden doll again in like a feverish masturbation session, staring at this little wooden figure. That thing breaks in half. He's trying to stab it. There were some rations buried outside that they dig up, but eventually they run out of booze and so gross. They start drinking fuel oil mixed with honey. And that's like the last night. That's before Pattinson tries to take off, before he loses his shit. Because you get this really, really weird scene with naked Defoe standing over Pattinson, like almost like a god in a way, with like this light shooting out of his face right down onto Pattinson, which is strange because he's having a vision of the mermaid, and then he looks down and it's Defoe that he's essentially having sex with, and then you get this crazy vision of Defoe with the light shooting out of his head, standing over top of him, almost like a stone, like a statue. Like,
yeah,
he's not moving.
Yeah, it was very
nothing.
Much like one of those classical paintings or like a statue.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, and it looked awesome. Like, that scene was great.
Oh, it was so cool. It was so well done, so well framed. Everything was right there. And so Pattinson then decides he's got to get the fuck out of there. Like, he's like, okay, I'm done. Like, I've got to leave. And there has been them telling each other back and forth, we don't know who to trust because we learned that both of them are liars. Like, Pattinson, you know, he wasn't using his real name. He was on the run. Defoe gives contradictory stories about what happened to his leg, why he was there. Like, at one point, he said he was stranded and got scurvy and then gangrene. Another point, he said he broke his leg and was in, like, a Catholic hospital where he fell in love with some nun. So we don't know who's telling the truth, who's crazy and who's not. And
also, after some time, it turns out they're both named Thomas. So while I was watching that, I felt like, I guess Thomas is like Robert Eggers' favorite name because his lead in the first movie was Thomason.
Yeah.
And now we got two guys. Well, at first, only one of them was called Thomas. Then suddenly the other says, I'm also Thomas.
Right. Yeah, we're both Thomas.
Yeah.
And the, yeah, so Pattinson is getting ready to leave. He wants to take off, and he ends up going to the lifeboat, and Defoe shows up with an axe and smashes the lifeboat into a bunch of pieces, and he's chasing, which was a really cool scene as well, where he's chasing him with the axe over his head, because it is that real tiny, tight frame. And so you see him chasing him. They get into the house and start having a conversation, and then Defoe's like, well, you just, why, you're going crazy, kid. Like, you don't even know what day it is. You don't know what's happening. You just broke apart the lifeboat, and chased me with an axe around like you were going to kill me. Like, you're going nuts.
And he says this in this kind of conviction where it feels like he really means it. Like, yeah. It's not just like the character trying to save his life. It feels like that's actually what happened, the way he says it. He's like so convincing.
Right.
And I think what we skipped over, though, was that there was the house was flooded a bit, or was that afterwards?
Because that's after the axe.
That happens then right after, because then he also finds the books.
Right. He finds the log books with everything in it, and that's when he calls him out. But that last night, right before that, so is when they get super drunk off the fuel oil. Yeah. And so they're drinking fuel oil mixed with honey, and they act very, very primal once they take the first like drink of it. They're like, whoa, hoo, 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 like sitting down at the bottom of the lighthouse. And I do love the scene, though, that same night when they're dancing, and he's like, dance, boy, dance. And he's got Pattinson doing a little jig, and then they're slow dancing with each other.
Yeah.
and they end up almost kissing, and Pattinson pushes him and throws his fists up, like old-timey fists up in the air.
Yeah, and then they're bare-knuckle boxing.
Right. And then Defoe's like, all right, well, let's do it then. And they just start beating the fuck out of each other. And they wake up the next day where Pattinson, and I could be confusing the timeline of this, whatever. Because, I mean, the timeline is kind of confusing as it is.
Yeah.
But I like the conversation when Pattinson really lays into Defoe, and he's like, you stop fucking talking, and I don't like any of your food. And he's like, say you like my lobster. And then Defoe stands up and gives this crazy monologue, like calling down the gods from the sky. And like, Poseidon's going to take you, and everything's going to strip your bones clean, and nobody's going to remember your name. And like, this just a wonderful, wonder. And that's one of the reasons I'm like, how did these guys not get nominated? Because it was so convincing and so good, the way he just lays into Pattinson. And then Pattinson, in a weird turn, is like, okay, I like your lobster. Like, doesn't buy into any of the shit that Defoe had just said to him. And he's like, yeah, your lobster's okay.
Yeah, but then also Defoe is really happy again, because that was all he cared about. Like, also not the whole thing where I hate that you fart all the time. I hate everything about you.
That's just later.
That he didn't like the lobster. That was the one thing.
But I think that was later, because the lobster thing I thought happened in their bedroom. And then now I'm trying to remember how it all happened, because I feel like after that, when Pattinson tries to go for the lifeboat, is once Defoe told him he was relieved of his duties. So that's when they woke up. You're right, when it was all flooded out. They wake up, and that's when Pattinson lays into him. He's like, you're a fucking liar. You're a liar, and you fucking fart. Oh, you farts. And he's like, you smell like, what did he say? He said, you smell like a fucking shanty house had sex with an oyster, and like all this stuff. Just like super lays into Defoe. Defoe keeps his cool through a lot of it. And that's when he's like, well, I got to say you're relieved of your duties. And Pattinson's like, well, good riddance. I'm out of here. Like, this is over. But did you notice at the end of it, they have that big fight and everything's all, you know, torn apart and it's all torn to shit. But I feel like when he came back in, everything was kind of pieced back together. Like, the window was whole. The table looked like it was back up.
I didn't realize that, but now that you say it, yeah. This whole movie is so confusing.
It is. And I think it works well that way, though, because as the viewer, you descend into madness with these men.
Yeah.
Like, you become a part of the madness where you can't trust what's real, what's not real, what's happening. And we didn't mention that Pattinson found the last guy's head in a crab trap.
Yeah.
I don't know what you call those. A crab trap, I guess, is the best way I can think to call it. But he pulls up the other guy's head, and then he's very accusatory, telling Defoe, like, you killed your last What do they call each other? Wikis? Wikis, I guess, are people
who man
lighthouses.
Yeah,
and
I
he's
think
like,
so.
I found your last guy, and you're a fucking liar. And now they just both go absolutely nuts. And we think that Defoe, they have a big fight, and we think that Defoe's been killed. And Pattinson's now, he's, you know, happy, Defoe's dead, and then Defoe shows up out of nowhere with an axe and just drives it straight into his shoulder. And that's when Pattinson drives the, or no, that was after he buried him. So he beats the fuck out of Defoe. That's where he sees his face as the mermaid, where he's covered in, like, seaweed. There's tentacles wrapping up around Pattinson's neck, and Pattinson's just punching the fuck out of his face. Like, he's sitting on top of him, punching him. And that's where we think, that's not where we think. He turns Defoe into a dog.
Yeah, that scene was where suddenly I felt kind of almost sad for Defoe, where all the time he was just like such an asshole and you kind of hated him. But then you felt like, okay, this is like really, really fucked up. And then, yeah, he turns him into a dog, puts a leash on him, tells him to woof like a dog. Yeah.
He's like, come on, laddie. He almost becomes Defoe in his tone and his cadence, like very authoritative. And he's like, roof. And so you've got Defoe on the ground, roof, roof. And then he puts this leash on him, like you said, walks him outside, and Defoe's on all fours, walking like a dog, and brings him to this big hole. He's like, now be a good dog, get in your hole. And he throws Defoe in this hole and just starts burying him alive.
Yeah, and just like putting dirt on him, and Defoe gives this great speech.
Good was it when it was so good, man. When he's talking and just getting buried at the same time, mouth full of dirt, and just keeps
like
delivering.
Every now and then swallowing the dirt and then going on talking. Like, that must have been fucked up scene to shoot for him. But yeah, he was totally in character, and like you could see him eating the dirt. Like, what else could he do? Not like spit it out, no.
He would just keep talking. He would just kept talking. Yeah. That's when Pattinson goes back in and Defoe comes barreling through the door and drives the axe into his shoulder. And then Pattinson takes the axe and just splits Defoe's head. We don't see it, but you hear the sound and you're very certain that Defoe is dead. And so now Pattinson has the keys to get up to the light, and that's his primary goal in life. He wants to get up and see what was in the light. And so we follow him. He works his way up to the light. And once he gets in there, you get this very obscure, almost David Lynchian ending. The whole thing, I feel like, could have been made by David Lynch.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of, it feels like David Lynch. You get this really obscure ending where the light opens up. And you see Pattinson's eyes just get wide. Like, he's staring, almost like the deadlights. It felt like the deadlights from It, where he's just staring into this light. And you get this crazy sound coming out of Pattinson. It's like a distorted metal scream. Like, we see him screaming, but the sound is not a human scream. It's so heavily distorted and just terrifying.
Then the whole screen lights up, like, it's brighter and brighter. And the whole movie, especially towards the end, it was really dark all throughout because it was mostly at night, rainy, and now it gets really bright. Like, the whole screen is basically just white and like lightning, and then we see Pattinson laying outside in front of the lighthouse.
No, you saw him get kicked down the stairs first. Because I thought in a way that was almost like the light had rejected him. Like, it spit him out, and he just goes ass over heels all the way down the stairs, down this spiral staircase. And then we get that nightmare final image of Pattinson somehow still alive, naked, laying outside on the rocks, getting devoured by seagulls. This guy's got a thing for birds eating people, now that I think about it. Because, you had the same thing in The Witch with the crow pecking away at the mom.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then you've got Pattinson, who's bloody and, for all intents and purposes, doesn't look like he should be alive.
Yeah.
He looks like he's in some sort of hell where he's just being feasted upon, you know, forever by these birds. And then fade to black, and you get a really cool old, like, sea shanty as the credits roll.
Yeah. It's suddenly happy again.
Yeah, it really was like a happier kind of a song.
Yeah.
I love this movie.
It's so open for interpretation. Like I've heard lots of things that people said what might be the story there. Like one that I really like is that they're both the same person. They're both called Thomas. They're both there. Like he's the younger one. The other one's the older one. And something about
that's
that.
That's cool.
There's like lots of theories, but no one can. I think this is one of those movies where there is no one answer. There's just like multiple answers.
And I read an interview with Robert Eggers who said, yeah, there's no, it's obscure, it's ambiguous. That's exactly what I wanted it to be because that's the kind of movies that I like. And so there is no right answer for this thing, which in a lot of ways with this kind of movie is, you know, I think it makes it a little more fun.
Yeah.
Because you can speculate, you can talk about it. But what really makes this movie shine is these two men's performances are just unbelievably good.
After we're done with this episode, I'm going to pull up and if I can find on YouTube the scene where Willem Dafoe does this great speech, because I loved it the first time and I want to see it again. And now just thinking about it, yeah, the performances of both of those were great. The cinematography was great as well. That's the only Oscar nomination they got.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
So mad about that. So mad.
And what's interesting is this is also written by Robert Eggers, but together with his brother.
Yeah.
Like, what's his name again? I think Mark,
Max.
Is it?
Max.
Max. Max Eggers, yeah. And I feel, as far as I know, they got the idea together before Eggers even made The Witch.
And oh, really?
Yeah, I feel so. And then they started writing it, and yeah. So I guess Max also has some talent, like his brother.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe there are going to be a future like Coens.
Yeah, maybe.
Or the Wachowskis. Yeah. But it's, man, it is just such a good movie. If you have not seen it yet, it is 100% worth your time. Some beautiful, beautiful imagery across. And like you said, Defoe's monologues. And Pattinson's, when he gives his at the end, when he's screaming at Dafoe and he's like shaking the house down and violently. Oh, it's just wonderful. Wonderful movie.
Yeah, it's wonderful, such a great movie and worth a rewatch. And
I think I'll probably watch it once a year for sure, because it's and just like The Witch, it's completely timeless. There's nothing where it's ever going to feel dated, nothing at all in this movie that'll make it feel.
Especially because it kind of made itself feel dated for some people by just being basically a square screen and in black and white.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's so good. Like, check it out if you haven't. Even though we just talked about everything, there's enough imagery in there.
Even the very first opening shot when they're both just standing there looking at the camera. You remember that when they're holding Pattinson's holding the supplies? And Defoe's just standing behind him. Like, it sets everything up so well. It's just marvelous.
Yeah, the movie's awesome.
All right, we're at an hour and a half. So, watch both those movies if you haven't seen them yet. And if you want to get into contact with us, we are at IHOH Podcast on all social media platforms. You can email us, IHOHpodcast@gmail.com. If you would like to be so kind as to leave a rate and review, that would be wonderful of you to do. We really appreciate those. So if you could jump onto Apple Podcasts, leave a rate and review. I haven't checked in a while. Not sure if there's any new ones, but I'll be sure to check next week.
I looked last week when we recorded. There were none, and I think there are no new ones this week.
Okay. Yeah, you no problem at all.
Just look into it. Really quick.
So you be the next one. You listener who hasn't left a rate and review yet, you be the next person to throw a rate and review out there. And for the International House of Horrors, I've been Joe Merle.
And I've been Josh.
And we'll be back next week with more things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre.